Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. This is going to be really good today because this is something that really, as someone who just was massively obsessed with everything West Wing, I'm going to love talking about this. Zach, who have we got on?
We have Mel Ayrton, who's an American history specialist with a particular eye on the presidents. And you can possibly guess where we're going to go on this one. I'm expecting a lot of what we term on History Hack shithousery. Don't know about you, boss, but I'm getting that kind of vibe today.
Yeah.
So he's written extensively on Bobby Kennedy, presidential threats and assassinations. His new book is all about how you go about protecting presidential candidates, which is probably just an absolute nightmare and just lots of kind of running around chasing your own tail.
I imagine that they would love you to think it's done pinpoint accurate at all times and that, but there's a lot of flying by the seat of your pants.
Yeah, I've heard this about Obama actually, that sometimes he would just get so sick of being in the, and this is the Secret Service, that, you know, president proper, he would get so sick of being in the bubble, as they call it, that sometimes he would just go rogue and do things that they're all going, no, you really can't do that. And he's going, I'm going to do it anyway. What are you going to do? I'm president. You're there to protect me.
Clinton caused uproar by going into a McDonald's wearing a pair of shorts.
I haven't heard that one.
I mean, obviously, this is pre-Trump, but everybody thought that was the end of the dignity of the office of the president when he went into McDonald's. But we've got a guest with us, haven't we, that is knows far more than we do.
Absolutely. Mel, so you've written about assassination plots as far as presidents are concerned, right back to Washington. How likely is it that someone is going to want to kill a presidential candidate? What kind of benefit do you get from that? And when do you first get presidential protection? Is that, see, in my head, I have this thing about Abe Lincoln gets assassinated the day that the Secret Service is formed. Is that right?
Well, you are correct in one sense, but it's nuanced. So I'll explain it, you know, a little bit more. First of all, to answer your question about how likely is it, every president and so many presidential candidates have been threatened. Now, people say, why would you want to threaten a presidential candidate? Well, it's quite clearly there are a few reasons. You've got the people who are mentally unstable, the people who have grudges against the government, and people who are politically inclined, meaning that they just hate the politics of the particular candidate. So those are the main reasons. And as I say, quite a lot have been threatened as the years go. A lot of these things have been hidden, of course, because the Secret Service are not inclined to discuss. Well, they won't discuss them. And I've contacted the Secret Service before and been given the brush off quite a few times. So how did I find out what I found out? Well, America's a free society, an open society. And of course, there are bureaucracies, and you know, bureaucracies are easily invaded by researchers like myself in a legal way. You know, I'm not a computer hacker or anything like that. So you'll have a Library of Congress, you'll have presidential libraries, you'll have oral histories, you'll have research centers like Miller Center, and you'll have such an awful lot of stuff. Which journalists don't access because they haven't got the time. And so, you know, the things that, you know, I found out, which are unknown in my three books, are just, you know, astounding and have surprised quite a lot of journalists, quite a lot of historians, and that these things have come to light. Going back to the next part of your question, Zach, when did it come about? Well, all presidents have been protected in some way. They've had aide secretaries. Often they've been soldiers around who give protection. But officially, you know, the official bodyguard didn't come with John Tyler. And that was in the middle of the 19th century. And he was given a bodyguard, you know, passed by Congress because of threats that he'd had. Then it moves on to the time of Lincoln. Now you have the Civil War. Of course, there's great fear that Lincoln would be assassinated. So you had Alan Pinkerton and his agents spent some time protecting Lincoln. And then you had soldiers on the White House grounds, of course, and there was always protection around him. Often, though, when Lincoln, you know, left the White House to go for a stroll, he'd take one of the doormen for his protection, bodyguard. When he was assassinated, he only had a police patrolman from the Washington Police Department who was at the White House, and it was his job. But historians can't agree whether he was there as Lincoln's bodyguard or he was there to escort Lincoln to Ford's Theatre. So he was there and then he left. But it's doubtful whether, you know, he would have prevented John Wilkes Booth from entering, you know, the box in the White House, the theatre box, because John Wilkes Booth was well known. He was known to Lincoln. And he was such a famous character that, you know, John F. Parker, who's the, you know, the police patrolman, would have probably just said, you know, well, you can go and see the president. I mean, it was that easy in those days, even though, you know, it was the end of the Civil War. On Lincoln's desk, during the Civil War, you had a Secret Service detective agency. It was a part of the military branch. Oh. But it had nothing to do with, you know, the modern Secret Service. It was an organization led by Alan Pinkerton, the famous Pinkerton Detective Agency. And Alan Pinkerton sent spies all over, you know, the Confederate States and, you know, to spy on the enemy. After the end of the Civil War, what Lincoln wanted, and he had this on his desk on the day he was assassinated, was an executive order creating the modern Secret Service, which was for counterfeiting. They never even thought about presidential protection at the time. But as time went by, the new Secret Service, which dealt with counterfeiting across the United States, developed into a dog's body, really, that other government departments would use them as detectives.
So this is why they're still under the Treasury's remit, the Secret
The Treasury Party. Department, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah, because of the counterfeiting. And also, people say, why was it called the Secret Service? Well, you know, it was a holdover from Alan Pinkerton's group of agents. And also, they tended in the 19th century to describe detectives as secret agents. Any detective, you know, police department detectives. So it was like a 19th century old-fashioned term. Just like they used the term crank when they meant would-be assassin. And that's one of the reasons I found out so much. Take, for example, newspaper archives in the Library of Congress. I was looking for things like would-be assassins, assassination attempts on the president, you know, on the search engines. And then suddenly, because I was looking at 19th century, you know, my book, Plotting to Kill the President, And so suddenly I got this idea. I came across this word that was used in newspaper reports called, the word was crank. It's an old-fashioned word. We don't use it now, but they did then. And a crank would be used to describe someone who made an attempt to kill the president or, you know, tried to get into the White House, break into the White House, which happened an awful lot of times. And it was for this reason that I came across unknown presidential assassination attempts.
This is brilliant. So I love that you've extended the remit to be presidential candidates as well, because this is key, I think. So you mentioned soldiers at the White House, and the president's cocooned in the White House. He's on his own turf, isn't he? But there's something very particular about the presidential election cycle that I think makes it a moment where you've got a better chance of offing one of them if you're minded to do so. So the layman in the audience, can you explain how a presidential election cycle works and what it means for the candidate in terms of exposure? You refer to it as the torture trail, don't you?
I do, yes, because it's a very, you know, grueling affair. Presidential candidates now begin their campaigns at least a year before. I mean, remember, if you go back decades, they wouldn't start the campaign until, you know, the Democratic convention or the Republican convention. But as time went by, they realized from the 1960 campaign, and that's the reason I started the story there, not just because of Kennedy's assassination, where everything changed with the Secret Service, but with the fact that the 1960 campaign was the campaign where it was so vitally important to go through the primaries, the primary system. Previously, it was the party bosses.
Is it in turn with television as well?
Television also, of course. Yeah. But most importantly, though, was the primary system, because people were getting sort of, you know, aware that, you know, you don't want party bosses to actually, you know, appoint, you know, the candidate. You wanted the people to do that. And they can only do that through the primary system. So now you have, it kept on changing as the years went by, the numbers. So now you'll have, you know, at least 20 important primaries.
Yeah.
And it's a grueling.
You have Super Tuesday, don't you? With the big
then
parties.
You have Super Tuesday, where you have so many of the state's primaries together at one time. And that would be in March. But the first one, in January, you know, the Iowa caucus, then you've got the important one. See, they never even considered Iowa many years ago until, the last few decades, really, because the first important primary was always the New Hampshire primary.
Yeah,
and that would be in February or March, something like that, late February. And that would set the stage. And if a candidate managed to win, you know, the New Hampshire primary, the media, you call it momentum. They had momentum and they would become, you know, they would become set to win more primaries. And that's the name of the game.
If anyone's seen The West Wing, the torture trail thing, I mean, so it is an exhausting year on the road, flying backwards and forwards, but it's written into the plot. Do you remember that Alan Alda's character literally can't shake hands with anyone by the week of the election because his hand is basically broken from so much handshaking over the preceding 12 months?
Right.
So they did cover it off. But you mentioned, so you've got these poor presidential candidates running all over the country, and it is a high level of exposure, isn't it? But you did start with Kennedy, as you've said, for more than one reason. But where are we in the historiography in terms of the protection at that point?
Okay. Presidential candidates had their own, you know, when they started on the campaign trail, they would have, if they were governors, for example, they would be protected by state police. Okay. You know, and I'm talking about Nelson Rockefeller governor, George Wallace governor. They had their contingent of state police guards until, you know, as time went by, the rules changed about when they would get Secret Service protection. And so as time went by, you would have the rules just changing. For example, there's a long list of rules now, and there wasn't before. For example, they would be offered secrets in the 60s and 70s. They'd be offered Secret Service protection, definitely when they became the candidate of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. John Kennedy, for example, he didn't have any official protection until he was the Democratic candidate. And that would be in July of 1960. Prior to then, they had to make their own arrangements. But as I say, that changed as time went by, and certainly after the assassination of JFK, certainly after the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy refused protection, actually. Lyndon Johnson offered Bobby Kennedy protection, but he turned it down. He was an anti-war candidate. He wanted to be seen by the people as, well, like today, a little bit of anti-police. He didn't want policemen around him because that took away from his images of a radical liberal candidate who was not establishment. And that doomed him in many ways, because if he'd had Secret Service protection, it's unlikely that he would have been killed. What they did instead was that he had two friends, Rosie Grier and Rafer Johnson, and a friend who's an ex-FBI agent called Bill Barry. So the three of them, and that was only during the California primary, the three of them protecting Kennedy. Now, if you've seen images of Robert Kennedy driving through Los Angeles with the crowds, hysterical crowds around him, pulling at him, taking his cufflinks and, taking his tie and all of that, you realize how incredibly unprotected he was with only those three guys. When it came to the Ambassador Hotel, though, where he was shot, the hotel hired the Ace security firm, but that was only for crowd control within the hotel. They weren't Kennedy's personal bodyguards. He only had those three that I mentioned. So really, by the time it got to the 1972 election with Nixon and McGovern, these things were in place that the leading candidate would have Secret Service protection. In fact, after Robert Kennedy's assassination, Lyndon Johnson said, "I want you to protect all of the candidates." Now, can you imagine at that time in 1968, because it wasn't just, Humphrey and Nixon then, there were still other candidates, and the expense involved, and really a hard job for the Secret Service at the time. And you were getting candidates who really they shouldn't have been candidates in the first place, because they had no support. They were doing it for the publicity and to say, look, I've got Secret Service protection, some small congressman, for example. So that process, that had to be dealt with. And as time went by, they weeded out these people who were just standing for president, and yet they had no real support at all.
I mean, that's an incredible run through that we've just gone through there. Can I just double back briefly and ask about JFK's assassination and the sort of subsequent impact? Do you see a sort of trickle down effect? So, obviously with JFK, there were a few things that changed. So, for example, open top cars, they're instantly out. Do you therefore see a replication of what's being learnt by the Secret Service then being applied to the presidential candidates? Or is there a disconnect and actually people are kind of just pushing their own individual ideas forwards when it comes to strategies for protecting these guys?
Well, after the assassination of JFK, the Secret Service were found by the Warren Commission to be pretty remiss in many areas of protection. That had to change. And the recommendations of the Warren Report were eventually put into place. For example, you had agents drinking at the nightclub in Dallas, the night before the assassination. That story was pretty scandalous. They tried to downplay it, but, it eventually came out. You had better technology, better weapons, and the obvious one, they hired more agents. So you had that part of it, that was a response to the assassination. But there was another effect that the assassination had for future protection, and that was the idea of copycat crimes. And that was the, I researched it. This hasn't been sort of well known, but I researched it even back in the 19th century. And you had presidential secretaries who were warning about copycat crimes. Well, it's one of the reasons why the Secret Service like to cover up things, like to hide things, really. It's because, you know, it's a pretty dangerous thing in society. After the assassination of JFK, and then you had Lyndon Johnson, who became president, and he ran a year later in the presidential election of 64. The number of threats were just incredible. They just multiplied. And the same thing happened with, if you look at the assassins, for example, after Oswald, you had Sirhan Sirhan. He read about Oswald. He wanted to be like Oswald. He wrote in his diaries, you know, I want to kill the president of the United States and be the second Kennedy assassin, so to speak. You had Arthur Bremer, who was, you know, the copycat as well, read about Hinckley, you know, went to Dallas. You know, the assassins of the past had such an incredible effect on the unstable individuals, you know, of the future. And that caused great, great disturbance to the Secret Service. After Reagan, after the attempt on Reagan by Hinckley, copycat, you know, finished the job, as it were, that Hinckley started. That threats increased enormously, at least 200% in the weeks following. So there was always that problem there about the copycat effect. The most important effect, actually, of all of the assassinations, and the most important effect that the Secret Service were worried about, and still are.
It's interesting that you say about kind of upping the game, the Secret Service upping their game when it came to weaponry, because I have something rattling around in the back of my mind about the attempt on Reagan's life. And one of Reagan's security detail trying to deploy his weapon, but he couldn't, and I'm trying to remember what it was, and I've got a feeling it was an Uzi, but he couldn't pull the stock out, and he's basically spent his entire time failing to pull the stock out, and so didn't shoot the guy who went and took a shot at Reagan. Is that a reflection? Sorry, you carry on.
No, it's okay, Zach. Right, an Uzi was pulled out during the, you know, in the vicinity where Hinckley was. But the other police officers, really, they only had time to react to cover the president. And then he wasn't hit directly by Hinckley. It actually hit the car door, or the car, a part of the car door, anyway. It hit the car door, and then it ricocheted and hit Reagan in the chest. The bullet ended up about just a centimeter or less from, you know, his heart. I mean, it was extremely serious, more serious than people have thought. They thought he, you know, he was wounded, then he recovered. No, he very, very, very nearly died. But when you talk about threats like that, when you talk about weaponry, remember today, the Secret Service were extremely worried by artificial intelligence weapons, you know, drones. In fact, there was one drone threat attempt on George W. Bush when he was running in 2000. And this guy, I think his name was called, I think his second name was Alford. Well, I have to check that. But he did. He was eventually caught, and, you know, he did jail time. Got a drone and was going to fit a bomb on a drone, and Bush was about to arrive at a football stadium. So even then, it was a worry with weapons like drones, but now it's the artificial intelligence ones that they're going to be really, really concerned about.
So what's the philosophy then for the Secret Service when it comes to weapons? Sorry, this is a very kind of nerdy thing, but it's an interesting kind of problem that these organizations have to think of. Do they want to be at the cutting edge of the technology in order to be able to deploy those cutting edge techniques, or do they want to be a generation behind so that you've got that kind of tested reliability, so you don't have a situation where you're trying to use something that doesn't quite work perfectly, all whilst trying to deal with the fact that you've got to be aware of what's at the cutting edge in case somebody tries to use that against the president. How do they get their heads around that problem?
Well, I think they get their heads around that problem quite easily, because I know that whatever the Secret Service asks for, they get. And the Secret Service always liaise with the CIA. They liaise with the FBI. The FBI, the closest actually agency to the Secret Service, because the FBI investigate a lot of the crimes involving presidential protection. National security advisors, all there. And of course, the scientific aspects, they will get what they need to combat any threat. Remember, you know, they have the beast now. I mean, you know, compared to JFK's Lincoln limousine, you know, this is, you know, the state of the art, bulletproof. It even has rockets to deploy and gas. And I mean, just incredible protection for a car. So yes, whatever they want, they will get.
Sorry, did you just say there are rockets inside the beast, the presidential limousine?
In the boot.
Okay, people, go read that book, you know?
Let's go back in time a bit and talk about some more of the candidates and that. I'm really interested in Jesse Jackson, because he really did stick his head above the parapet, didn't he? Can you tell us why?
He did. Well, Shirley Chisholm was the first African-American candidate back in 72, but, you know, she didn't have a chance, let's face it. She just didn't, and most historians know that. The one who did possibly have a chance was Jesse Jackson. But unfortunately, as his campaign went on, he made a big mistake. His big blunder, which lost him an awful lot of support, was the fact that he accepted Louis Farrakhan's support. Louis Farrakhan still is, I think, the head of the Black Muslims in the United States, which is a very anti-Semitic organization. Jesse Jackson made a speech in support of Farrakhan, but at the same time, Jesse Jackson also talked about Hymietown. He was talking about New York, and he called it Hymietown, an extremely ill-considered description of New York. And that really, his poll numbers just naturally plummeted. So he started off with, you know, a lot of people were excited. I remember, well, in 88, I was living in America, and he stood in 84. Of course, he lost out to Walter Mondale. And then in 88, he stood again, and, you know, there was still excitement there about his candidacy. But he lost out to Michael Dukakis on the 88 nomination. But, so in 1984, standing against Mondale, he made these blunders. Oh, there's also links with Libya. That really didn't do his candidacy any good. Putting that to one side, though, of course, he was the first viable African-American candidate, and that meant that you'd have extremists, extreme right-wingers coming out of the woodwork wanting to kill him. And of course, both campaigns, there were about 311 threats against his life. Many of them were serious. Many of them, the Secret Service investigated, and quite a few people did jail time for that one. The most important one was a real plot, which very, very nearly came to fruition. But it was an informant who actually did that plot in, as it were. But it was very serious indeed, yeah. So Jesse Jackson, of course, you know, followed that up by Barack Obama all those years later. An African-American candidate, yes. I mean, racists wanted to kill him.
How different was Obama's experience to Jesse Jackson's in terms of the number of threats and things like that?
Just as bad, really, when he was a candidate. Yeah. Which is why he received Secret Service protection long before the other candidates. And quite rightly too. There were quite a few plots, as readers will, you know, see if they read the I'm trying to think which one it was, the first book in the series, which is Hunting the President. Very serious threats, which were foiled by the Secret Service. But then, I think they went about 400%, a figure of that nature. But then when he became president, they dropped. And the director of the Secret Service said he was receiving no more threats, you know, per year than any of the other press, any previous president.
Isn't that interesting? Like, appear to get over themselves.
Yes, sorry.
I said that they just appear to get over themselves once he gets selected.
Well, no, you still receive. They still receive. Obama still received threats. I mean, you know, all presidents.
But that big wave of racism.
But not as incredible. You know, the incidents weren't as incredibly as high as when he was running for president.
Let's rewind a little bit then and talk about the mid-70s and Gerald Ford, because he makes himself perhaps more of a target, is it fair to say, than he would ordinarily have been, in part because, you know, he goes and pardons Nixon. So he's become president without being elected, but is he in real danger during the campaign to then get elected? Because, you know, he's acting president, so therefore, you know, fair company. He's got the protection already.
When Ford took over from Nixon, Ford was very popular indeed, because he was seen as the guy who healed a nation. Because America went through this terrible period, the Watergate period. I mean, you know, the things were coming apart at the seams. And they saw Ford as silly Nixon. A lot of people were disappointed when he pardoned Nixon. Would that make him a target? Well, you know, it's hard to say. But what I do know is that the threats against him were in line with all the previous threats and all the, well, future threats as well. And that he was a symbol. He was president of the United States. And that's an important thing as well. That there's two groups of assassins. One group are the ones where you would get, you know, it's the politics all the time. They are political fanatics, whether they're on the right or the left. The other area are the ones who don't care. Take Arthur Bremer. He stalked Nixon before he targeted George McGovern. So Nixon's on the right, George McGovern's on the left, and then back to Wallace, George Wallace, who he eventually shot, is on the right. So the actual, you know, there wasn't anything, you know, wasn't any personality involved there. It was the fact that he was a leading, he might become president, or he was president. That was the target. It was the symbol. Politics to Arthur Bremer, well, he didn't have any really, apart from crazy thoughts, you know, because he was quite an odd character. Same with Hinckley. Hinckley stalked Jim Carter and got very near Jimmy Carter, actually, before he turned his attention to Reagan, because he gave up on Carter, because by that time the press was saying that Reagan was going to win the 1980 election. And so he gave up on Carter, concentrated on Reagan, but didn't get to attack Reagan until after Reagan was inaugurated in the January of 1981, and he was shot in the March. So you have two groups there. Now, this is outside the terrorist groups, okay? You've had all kinds of terrorist groups who've made threats against the president, even Puerto Rican nationalists, as well as, you know, Islamists. So outside those political groups, when you have the individual, the lone, you know, the lone wolf assassin, these are the ones I'm talking about who you know, are grave danger to presidential candidates and presidents.
What about foreign threats as well? Is there any evidence of that, or is that something that, you know, the CIA would just quietly tuck away in a file and nobody would ever see it?
Well, yes, the CIA would, with the Secret Service, investigate foreign threats. Of course they would. I remember way back in the 1980s, you know, they were concerned that Gaddafi was sending a team of assassins to America to kill Reagan.
So they're judging them by their own standards of sending someone to kill Fidel Castro, maybe.
Well, you know, Fidel Castro was a pretty lucky guy. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're talking about hundreds of attempts Castro's life. Some of them were quite, you know, I guess meaningless in the sense that they were like somebody just threw a stone at him or something like that. But basically, yes, they wanted to kill Castro. Yeah. The CIA with the mafia organized that one.
You've mentioned Reagan a couple of times already. Is he difficult to protect in that he's already famous, isn't he? He's a film star, so he's already got a certain type of fame. Is trying to show him how different presidential fame and political fame is in terms of danger to his own person, do you think that was difficult for the Secret Service?
No, because anyone who becomes president is automatically famous worldwide.
Yeah.
So I know that Reagan was famous before then as governor of California and as a movie star. Mm. But the reason why it was more dangerous for Reagan and Robert Kennedy and Jesse Jackson as well is because they were charismatic figures. And that's one of the keys to understanding why these people were targeted. And all three of them, of course, were targeted.
Were they all targeted by the lone wolf type as well?
Well, the Libyan ones, of course, you know, that they were targeted by a team of Libyan assassins. They never got as far as getting across the United States, by the way. But yeah, I mean, most of them are lone wolf. But the thing with the three guys I mentioned was that they attracted love and hate in equal measure. I mean, that applied to John Kennedy, you know, charismatic president, but he had just as many people who hated him. And the same applied to Reagan and the same applied to Jackson and Robert Kennedy. So it's that type of politician who attracted intense feelings in, especially in mentally unstable people, not just the political fanatics.
Carry on.
Sorry, Jack. I was going to say, you know, that these would be assassins and would be assassins. They were trying to gatecrash into history, really. That they were nobodies who wanted to be somebodies. And they thought they could do this with, you know, the most charismatic and the most famous. That gives them more infamy. So there's a connection there.
There's an elephant in the room of this whole thing, isn't there? Which is the Donald. How do you go about trying to protect Trump, not only from those who would do him harm, but also with the best will in the world, sort of from himself?
Yes, I know what you mean. You would ask his generals and his aides in the White House about how they dealt with Donald Trump. And there are quite a few memoirs have come out, you know, since Donald Trump lost the presidency, about working with him. And, well, it was difficult. He's a very impulsive character. When it comes to Secret Service, though, it's a different matter altogether. Because the vast majority, from my understanding, really liked him because he showed a lot of respect for the Secret Service. And remember, the Secret Service are like a military-type organization. They respect punctuality. Unlike Clinton, you know, the famous stories about Clinton, he just wasn't punctual. That caused an awful lot of problems for his Secret Service agents. But with Trump, no. And if the agents gave him advice and told him, you know, you have to do this, and usually he did it. There are exceptions. For example, when he, I remember one incident where he was in the Beast, And he was just near his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, and he got out to shake hands with the crowd. And, you know, things like that always take agents off balance. And, you know, it's always a dangerous time. So apart from, you know, a few exceptions like that, generally speaking, the agents respected them and thought he was very nice to them.
Is there anyone who has a reputation for just being the biggest pain of the ass out yes. of all of them? And if so, are you willing yes. to sort of
yes.
spill I'm, the beans?
Oh, Lyndon Johnson.
Really?
Oh, God, Lyndon Johnson was a bully. He was egotistical. He was just, you know, a really, he was a big man. He was 6'4", and he used to lord it over his other senators and, you know, his staff in the White House. He used to bark and boss people around. He was insulting agents as well. You know, he used to do that. So many
stories all over here.
Some of which you can read in Hunting the Press. Yeah. Well, actually, I've got stories about Johnson as well when he was a candidate. You remember after the JFK assassination, you had all these measures came in, which were meant to provide further protection for the president. When Lyndon Johnson went campaigning in the 64 election, he just really caused so much upset because he was getting out of his limousine, he was standing up in his limousine. And remember, this is just the year, less than a year after the assassination. And, you know, he on his ranch, he'd drive off and Secret Service agents would have to scurry after him. You know, he'd drive off at a moment's notice on his ranch, used to get in his limousine on his ranch and just drive at 100 mile an hour, you know, across his land, across the ranch. He had a car which was amphibious, and he used to shock some of his guests. And his agents, obviously watching on, used to shock some of his guests. He had a lake, small lake on his ranch. And he used to drive this amphibious car down to the lake and just go into the water. And his guests used to be horrified because he didn't realize it was amphibious.
He sounds like such a dick. I just, when we come off air, I'll tell you about the member of the royal family that has exactly the same
reaction. Okay.
So, I've heard similar
in
stories.
In the meantime, I'll guess which one.
Yeah, it's not hard, is it? Hard.
No, it's not. Actually, you're right. It's not hard. Does it begin with an A?
No comment. That's outstanding. Thank you so much for coming on to give us a bit of an introduction into how you go about keeping these men safe where they're trying to go about being the leader of the free world. We will have to have you back to talk about the litany of actual assassination attempts, especially because we love laughing at idiocy on History Hacks, and maybe we'll laugh at some of the most stupid attempts.
A lot of stories about the most bizarre assassination attempts. I'll give you a sample. Clinton, right? There was an assassination plot against Clinton by the Republic of Texas movement. And these guys thought that they could put a cactus stem into a Bic lighter. It was poisoned with, I don't know, sarin, I think it was, something like that. They would get near to the president and inject him. You know, so it was like assassination by injection. Just totally bizarre. there you go.
It sounds a bit like some of those nutty CIA experiments that you hear about.
I can tell you a lot about those as well, yeah. Planting a seashell on the seabed so Castro would swim along. And they press a button and the shell would explode, and exploding cigars. I mean, just so many, you know, silly stories like that connected with, well, the stories aren't silly, the stories are true, but, you know, silly ideas. People think that, you know, the likes of the CIA and the FBI, you know, you've got like 100% Perfection. Well, as you well know, Zach, look, people are human beings. And sometimes, you know, you have imperfect people working in organizations.
There's one that I know about, which will anger Alex, which was a plan to embed radio listening devices within cats, using the cat's tail as an antenna.
Leave the cat alone.
Yes. Yes.
It's you, not as right bad as the carrots and Hitler.
Well, the one I heard was that they would obviously to get at Castro, you know, they wanted to destroy the economy. And the staple of the Cuban economy was sugarcane. So they sent cats, they tied torches to cats' tails and sent them into the sugar fields. Yeah, that is a true story. Yeah.
That's bizarre. Just
definitely
bizarre.
Going to have you back for an episode on bizarre assassination attempts.
Yes.
Mel, this has been brilliant. We're going to stick your books on the History Hack bookstore. Are you on social media? Can people kind of follow you and stay up to date with what you're working on?
I'm not really very good at it, Zach. I mean, my publishers, like many years ago, got a tweet account from me. Suddenly I'm presented with this tweet and I didn't know how to work it. You know, I mean, I'm really computer illiterate. And I mean, I've got Facebook just for friends in America and family, but that's just private, really. I mean, I don't really broadcast stuff like that. I rely on the publishers to do all of that marketing stuff. Yeah.
Well, folks will have listened to this. I know they're going to want to check out your books. Folks, just have a little search for Mel Ayton on the History Hack bookstore. Mel, can't wait to have you back already. We're going to get off air and I'm going to book you in for something straight away because this has just been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Zach.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great